You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson. I was just drinking a cup of tea then and it got called out. And for the next hour, we will be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my fellow presenter, Ollie Lloyd of the Great British Chefs. Hello there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, good, good. I just wanted to ask you a question. What is a condiment? What does that mean?
I think we have to ask our guest one that question. I think it's something that goes with something is the way I think of it. It's a sauce on the side. But then again, then what's not a sauce and not a... It's a really good question. We'll have to open it up.
I thought you would know that.
You thought I'd have an answer.
That. Yeah, yeah.
It goes with everything is the answer.
It goes with something that goes with everything.
Good with everything.
Good with everything.
Mm. Doesn't sound very definitive. Our guests today are Frankie Fox, the lovely Frankie Fox, who we've met a lot from Foraging Fox, and Viva Kaunikaita from New Food. Now, Frankie is a condiment maker, so we're going to ask you all sorts of things about condiments in a minute. And Viva is like an expert on food, 3D food printing. Can't wait to find out what that is. I don't even know what it is, actually, but can't wait to find out about that. So, first off, Frankie, what is a condiment?
A condiment is good with everything. Yes, it's something that you can put with anything you're eating.
So it's just something on the side?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And you said you've done some research, Ollie, on condiments recently at Great British Chefs.
Yes, so we do lots of research in order to try and understand what foodies in the UK are doing. And what we want to understand recently was how far the DIY food revolution had gone. And by that, we want to know how many people were making their own vinegar, making their own beers, making their own wine, making their own condiments. And so we did this research nationally. This is not just with our audience. We did it with our audience and we also did it nationally in order to understand it. And interestingly, in terms of making condiments, so interestingly, we did actually say making condiments, e.g. ketchups, mustards, etc.
Just in case people didn't know what condiments meant.
Including me. So you see, I wouldn't have answered it. So 8% of the UK have made condiments.
Made condiments. So like their own ketchup
have you
or
made
mustard.
Your own, yeah. So to put that in comparison, 3% of the UK have made their own vinegar.
Made their own vinegar?
Yeah.
I don't know how you make vinegar.
That's the whole process. We'll work with that another time. 4% have made beer and 5% have made wine. So it's quite a big... What's interesting is that the number then increases dramatically. By the time you get to the Great British Chefs audience, it's up at 32% of people have made a condiment. But then again, our audience are pretty committed.
Is Piccalilli a condiment? No.
Yes, it probably is.
I made Piccalilli. Yeah, I love making Piccalilli. Yeah.
And it's part of the old school stuff that I think people are rediscovering.
Mm. So, Frankie, ketchup, that is definitely a condiment, that goes without saying. And you've got the Foraging Fox beetroot ketchup. Now, I have the smoked version in my fridge. That's the one I like the best. Hot's a bit too hot for me.
Yeah, we remember that. There was a hot incident a few months ago.
But you've also got the original, haven't you?
Yes. I think hot is such a subjective thing because some people would consider this just as a warm hug. Whereas other people do think, it's got two sources of heat. It's got the horseradish, which is a kind of rising heat, and then it's got the chili, which is that sort of lip tingling.
See, I love horseradish.
It's the chili that got you then.
Probably. Now you've been making these beetroot ketchups for a couple of years now, haven't you?
Yes.
And they are becoming incredibly successful.
Oh, thank you.
Well, they are, aren't they? I mean, you can get them everywhere now. Every time I go into a supermarket, I just see your Foraging Fox everywhere.
Yes. Well, a fox is an opportunist animal.
It's very good. and initially, you're inspired by your dad.
Yes.
Tell us all about Roland Fox. He sounds like an amazing guy.
So, yes, the Foraging Fox is named after my father and sort of in homage. He was a plant mushroom expert, so I was brought up foraging. We hadn't an awful lot of fun.
Just, do you not have enough money to buy proper food?
There's no fun in that. No. I think that's probably, yeah. So, you know, a walk would be turned into a forage. You know, things would be brought back, things would be cooked up. We had secret places where chanterelles were grown.
Where did you live?
Central London.
No, exactly. It's clearly not Brixton.
You can actually, even though, I mean, this weekend I was actually cycling in Palmer and I had to stop because I found a bilitis, a sep. My husband's like, you've got nowhere to put it. So I couldn't sort of grab it and cycle off with it. But, I mean, you know, my father would always... You know, there'd be a step at the side. We would stop on hard shoulders to pick up giant puffballs and things like that.
But how do you know what to do? I mean, I'll be petrified of picking the wrong thing. I mean,
and rightly.
Right. Okay. I mean, eating it and then not waking up in the morning is not a really good test,
no,
is it?
It's not the way I'd want to go.
No. So how do you learn? How do you learn? Because I'd love to pick mushrooms.
Well, I mean, my dad, years of being a mycologist and years of knowledge and practice. But even him, I mean, even... You can get fooled, you know, and he's given himself, I remember him giving himself a few pretty nasty turns, you know, with some odd omelettes, so odd mushroom omelettes. So I think you've got the books. I mean, for me, I always say if it's got a spongy bottom, underneath the gills are all spongy.
You just described me there.
A spongy bottom.
I've got a spongy bottom.
I can eat you. So, no. But that's the bilitis, that's a sep, and that's a pretty good indicator that sort of family.
So what do you mean by spongy bottom, all jokes aside? What's that bit?
If you turn it over and there's the gills, you see gills usually are sort of stripes, but if it's spongy... that is it's a distinct family of the bilitis family where you get the seps from, and they're tasty and they're really obvious. Whereas, you know, with
and
things
so
like...
there's none of those that are poisonous, is that what you're saying?
I'm not, saying by the way, that you're pretty safe with
I am
those.
Not advocating anybody who's listening to this programme to go and pick any mushrooms at all. Need an expert with you. But in essence, those ones are generally okay.
They're generally okay. Because even things like, you know, the chanterelles, which are delicious, there's a false chanterelle, which looks just like it, you know. So... I mean, even I've got a brilliant
I always felt confident with chanterelles. I'm like, yeah, this is easy.
It depends on where you find them. So, but there is a, you know, they are slightly different. And I've got this brilliant app. So it's just, I've got the, so I used to have this big mushroom book. Now I've got an app, which I'll show you afterwards. But you can start sort of by piecing it together, saying, well, where did you find it? What does it look like? And what colour is it? And it starts piecing it down. And then you can, it says, right, there's a whole load of these. And it has like skull and crossbones next to some. And, you know, and you can start sort of like narrowing it down. But I'm coming from the knowledge that I would not eat things that I don't feel 110. Yeah. I mean, I used to take photos and text them to my dad saying, can I eat?
Yeah.
And he was like, check this, check that, check that.
Whoever made that app, they better have some really good terms and conditions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
We accept no responsibility. Exactly. Only for identification purposes.
Only. But, I mean, I take my kids now. I mean, we all go, I mean, autumn is brilliant. You take them out and, you know, just joy at finding a mushroom. I mean, you know, my kids will phone me up and say, we found a mushroom in the garden. It's all right. We've kind of fenced it off, you know, so I get the gardening gloves for me to touch it. But
so I get mushrooms in my lawn. You know, because we live in England and it's damp. Can I eat those? No.
Oh, goodness me. You never know. It could be anything from magic mushrooms to toadstools. I'd be very careful.
Oh, okay.
So the answer depends on what you want.
Exactly.
An outcome.
But it could be field mushrooms. You know, it depends on what they are, really.
Oh, but not then. I just mow them over like I normally do then with a lawnmower.
It's one of the things I'm really interested in, is actually what percentage of the UK is foraging. Do you think foraging is a word that's understood? Because we've debated this and we're quite keen to put in some research in January. Mm. But do you think people would understand if I said, have you foraged? Do you think that's understood?
Yeah, because I've taken the kids out a lot when they were younger and gone to pick, you know, elderberries and hazelnut, you know, all sorts of things like that, nuts and berries, which we're quite happy with. Or wild garlic, actually.
Yes,
that's great.
Love wild garlic.
Because you can smell it, you know, a mile off. I suppose that is foraging.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely it is.
You were talking about clams and things like that. It's all foraging. I mean, rose hips, sloes.
We've picked loads of sloes, damsons. Yeah, made loads of damson gin. That's brilliant.
It's so much fun. There's so much you can do.
And somebody said to me, do you make damson jam? I said, good God, no. When you can make dams and gin, why would you make dams and gin? But so really, that is foraging. And kids love it, don't they?
Yeah, let's face it. Absolutely love it. You just, all you need is a plastic bag in an afternoon, and you can, you know, you can go along hedgerows, you can find all sorts, and you don't have to eat it all. Sometimes, you know, you just go back and identify it. We have as much fun identifying it, and then we can decide what we're going to turn it into. You know, some things are more successful than others.
But, and important for children to understand where things come from, I think. It's really good for them to pick blackberries or, you know, whatever it might be. We had the most fabulous walnut tree, really old walnut tree near us. And I used to wait every year, couldn't wait. And it's fabulous, huge, huge tree. But the kids love that, you know, picking all the nuts off the ground.
But it also connects you with the seasons. And that's, you know, that sort of idea that you, there's a moment. You
we're
know,
waiting,
the walnut
waiting.
Tree comes and there's that, we're going to go and do that. And it's sort of, it's a wonderful ritual that isn't
it's
about...
It's a rhythm and a ritual, as you say. And it is about patience. It's about things ripening. It's about, you know, delayed gratification. And it's also about spending quiet time searching for things together. You know, it's a really nice time, you know, as you can sort of find things together and then you can decide what you're going to identify them, decide what you're going to do with them and then eat them. You know, it is such a fun thing.
Ivor, is there anything that you've done as a child? Did you get dragged through doing that? I mean, I was brought up in inner city London, so that never happened to me, but which I think is why I was keen for my children to do it. But.
A lot, actually. We've done a lot of foraging as kids because I grew up in Eastern Europe. So foraging is part of the culture. So picking mushrooms, so I just kind of know three key mushrooms and what they look like.
And stick to that.
And lots of different berries. Blueberries was a big thing that I used to spend hours and hours, days sometimes, with my grandma in forests picking, which was really good fun.
I love those blueberry collecting. I remember I went to Norway and they had sort of blueberry collecting sort of thing where you sort of run this thing through bushes.
No, there's no fun in that.
No, imagine the kids, they love this little thing.
It's
like this little scoop. It's tiny. I mean, you know, it's like a little scoop that allows you to pull them off.
Wild strawberries. And even wild raspberries. We were in the Alps this year. And a walk that probably should have taken us 20 minutes took us about 2 hours. We couldn't, because everyone was spotting them. And sort of,
When you consider where you're going to go on holiday, is foraging a key decision maker?
I don't think my family would
allow that.
But we're lucky enough, we spend a lot of time in the Alps. And actually in the summer, I love it as much in the summer, if not more than the winter, because of... the wonderful walks and just the huge variety of things that you can pick and see.
And have you ever done the sort of truffle thing?
Yeah, I've still got the British... as a child, I got the British record for finding the most truffle, 103. I think I still hold it.
Really?
I was on London Tonight with Jenny Barnett and I was pitted against a sow... with a man in a smock.
So you versus a pig.
And an electronic nose and a spaniel. And there was Roland Fox and his secret weapon, his daughter. And by that time I was probably, I think I must have been 11, so I was suddenly getting very, very self-conscious about, you know, I think I was wearing a Cure T-shirt and I probably had to be paid.
bribed in order to do it,
because I'd got the record a couple of years before, and you know it was fun. I used to go on, Fungus Forest with my dad most weekends, and we'd camp and we'd do all these things. But suddenly, you know, that turned to wanting to spend more time roller discoing and hanging with my friends. So
And truffles, you can find them in the UK.
Yes, but these were inedible ones, unfortunately.
Right.
So
okay.
Some are very small.
And how do you find them? I mean, just because you know the sorts of places where they're likely to be.
Yes, so you'll have historical records and being found there, but then also animals are probably better than us. So you look where animals have been, because they're very tasty for little squirrels and rabbits and things.
Absolutely gorgeous. So coming back to your actual product, beetroots. Why beetroot? I love growing beetroot, and it's so easy to grow.
Yes, that's possibly why they're incredibly successful to grow. And probably I underestimated how successful they could be.
So did you start off with an allotment or something in your garden?
Yeah, so we bought sort of an old place with a big vegetable garden. And so I said to the kids, this is our project. So we cleared everything, cleared all the weeds, prepared all of the... all of the beds, and then we set to sewing stuff. And by the end of that year, we just sewn so many beetroot. We could not, I mean, there were, we were trying to find new and imaginative ways that we could be eating these beetroot. And it's the same year that we had a glut of apples. So suddenly, and you know, beetroot and apples are such brilliant combination.
And the problem is when you grow it and you've taken time to do it, you just don't want to waste it, do you?
Yeah, some things you can't freeze, you know. Right. And that's when I started, like, you know, I really started looking, because we had an old Mrs. Beaton book and we had all of these preserving books and we had such fun just looking through stuff and saying, what can we do? And then once you start doing that, you start experimenting or you get the recipes wrong. And, you know, it just turned into really, really fun sort of family
project.
So
it wouldn't have just been ketchup for you. You'd have had beetroot, everything, would you?
What was the worst?
What was the absolute worst that you wouldn't recommend you did with a beetroot, if you'll pardon the expression?
Gosh, well, the thing is, I mean, I'll eat vegetables raw. I mean, I like beetroot raw. So I'll eat runner beans raw. Try and eat most things raw to give it a try, apart from potatoes, never good. But, I think we did an awful lot of different combinations. Some definitely were better than others. And kids are ruthlessly honest, so if you're...
Well, that's good. They're the best tasters and testers of anybody.
It also goes well with chocolate, so I'm sure there are a fair number of beetroot cakes and stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a wonderful colour, and it's really moist texture as well. No, yeah, beetroot cake, yeah.
So ketchup proved to be the most successful.
Yes.
Really.
Well, it does. It hits all of those taste buds, doesn't it?
Because you won the gold in the Food Talk Awards that we did earlier this year. Yeah. And when we had the judging panel, well, particularly Russ Shaw, who was one of the judges, went bananas for it and asked if he could take all the bottles home with him. And he couldn't believe that there was a really good alternative to Heinz, you know, tomato ketchup. And there is something about it, the texture's really good, but it's just got that little twist on it that is just enough, that is traditional enough, but it's just got a twist on it enough, I think, for it to be used almost every day, which some people do with tomato ketchup.
Yes, well, I think the beauty of cooking with children is cooking as a family. And also, I mean, I took ramekins and, you know, kilners to people's parties. I mean, I probably was shunned socially after, you know, taking so many and getting people to blind taste it. Because as you say, texture is really, really divisive. Yeah. And, you know, everybody's slightly different. But
ketchup's got to blob.
Yes.
Hasn't it?
Yep.
It can't be too runny.
Yeah.
So I can recommend. I know you only use the finest ingredients. So the 100% natural, certified gluten-free, suitable for vegans, da-di-da-di-da, all that's really important, actually, I think, for condiments. And you're in Sainsbury's and Waitrose and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we're actually in Whole Foods in the US now as well. It's absolutely mind-blowing to think
really good.
That it started as a glut of vegetables in our garden. I mean, for the children to see the progression from something that we grew, you know, talking about delayed gratification, you know, and it's grown and it's changed.
And they've been part of that, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
Part of that development.
They still do samplings.
Which is very rewarding.
However, very cheap as well.
Yeah. It's very cheap, yeah.
Enthusiastic.
However, that's not your background at all, is it? Not at all, despite lovely Roland taking you out and teaching all these things. So you got a degree in law in London,
yes.
And then you were an international tax advisor. Can't get much more boring than that with PwC. And then you spent some time doing, you know, business development and investment and things like that. And you'd been at Credit Suisse.
Yes.
So all of that sort of proper grown-up banking jobs. And obviously, presumably, you had children. So why did you go into food? Because it is notoriously difficult to make it work and to make a living out of it, actually. And it can be great as a lifestyle business, of course. But if you seriously want to get into supermarkets, it's a business like any others.
Absolutely. I think what motivated me is, unfortunately, you know, the businesses you were talking about, it's very difficult to spend time with your family because they are very full-on, long-hour jobs. And I felt, you know, I wanted a bit more autonomy in my life. I wanted to bring my children up. I was lucky enough to have a lot of time I spent with my parents, and I wanted to have the same for my children. So I had my children very close together. I think this sort of but 17 and a half months between them, so it's practically a blur. So I just wanted to slow down, spend some time with them, and really just, you know, it's about sort of, I guess after Dad had died, it really did make me appreciate how much of a legacy he just left with me. You know, and it's about sort of passing that legacy on. His, you know, love, passion and love of food is, you know, it's something that I can pass on and give to my children, and I can appreciate, I can see my father in them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I find it really difficult to make that decision, again, you know, holding sort of, you know, high profile jobs, and then all of a sudden your kids come along. And if I step back from that, I know I'm going to go back quite a few years. Will my job still be there when I go back? How can I do that job part time? Yeah. Does that work? Not necessarily,
it's
actually.
So binary, isn't it?
You wish it could work, but it doesn't always. I don't want somebody else bringing my children up, but actually I want them to see a role model of a mum going out to work. I mean, it's absolutely fraught with difficulty. And luckily these days, more and more, you know, more and more men are taking part in bringing up the children, which is great. But, God, it's hard, isn't it? I mean, you must find the same. Ollie, it's you've got really young children and you've got a high-profile job too.
Yeah, and my wife works, you know, does VR at The Guardian. So, you know, there's the two of us, but one wants that stimulation, and I think it's, you know, one wants to try and show a role model, as you say. There is no answer to this balance.
Apart from being tired all the time.
Yeah. I think there is a permanent state. You just think, you know, am I doing the right thing? You've just got to trust in slowing down and being sort of emotionally available and physically being available. But also, I mean, there is ambition. I wouldn't have...
Yeah.
So when you do something, you kind of think, oh, I could do that a little bit better. I want to make more of a success, and you know, my co-founder and business partner also had. I mean, I used to work with her, and she's got two young children. And finding that balance, being your own boss as a woman, you can go to the Harvest Festival, and
I'd rather not actually. I hated all those things at school. I used to go, you know, when they said ballet display. Like, oh, I'm terribly sorry, kids, I can't make that one.
The violin recital.
Yeah, it's okay for sports day, but no, not ballet or violin recitals.
But it does give you that flexibility, and also because you're putting so much into it, you want to be able to have a bit more control over it. And I think, yeah, nowadays, I think it's the role model is not is as important for my daughter as it is for my son.
Of course.
And they've seen big part of it right from the start. And I think for them, it's not just a straw to plate anymore. It's suddenly it's turned into a capitalist
proper business. A proper business, yeah.
So what's the ambition for it? So where are you going with it?
I think that there is a burning ambition that I feel that I want to bring it to more consumers. So, you know, you just, it's food is such a joy you want to share. And I think that is something that drives you. It's something that draws humans together. It's in our DNA. It's, you know, this shared love of food. And so there is an enormous amount of passion behind, you know, you have this business and suddenly you want everyone to try it. You want them to love it. What I love about the social media is people saying, have you tried it with this? Have you tried it with that?
Yeah.
Suddenly we're linking people together, and it feels more, you know, we're in an age where everybody sort of seems to be disconnected. Food is that one thing that draws everyone together. And I think something, there's a huge amount. So the ambition is, you know, it makes it sort of, it's just, you just want to carry on sharing it, and the more opportunities, the more you want to do it, and, you know.
But surely your business background has helped, in terms of developing it, because I know that you used to be a private bank advisor and a business advisor, so some of that must have helped. Although I bet it was really interesting being a business advisor, not having your own business, and then all of a sudden you have got your own business, probably your advice would be different now.
It's a bit like, I guess, if you're a parent talking to somebody who doesn't have children, but or, you know, the same.
The advising.
The advising. So I think it gives you an innate confidence in yourself and your abilities, although, having children and maybe not doing things for a couple of years takes quite a lot of confidence out of a woman, because you're spending your time doing lots of other things. So going back and building up your confidence as, you know, not just as a mum, but as a self. So this has been, you know, and for me also, you know, it's been grief counselling. So because I said it after Dad died, it's enabled me to talk about, you know, my family and him in such a sort of a positive manner. And I've sort of managed to channel all of that into the business. So, you know, it's, yeah.
Because every food product now feels like it has to have a story, you know, artisan product. Because people want to know that story, actually, I think.
Yeah.
And why you started it, why you're mad enough to start your own food company or your own food product. And so to be able to talk about Roland and explain what he did and his contribution must be, well, I don't know whether it's cathartic or it must be poignant at the same time.
Yes. I mean, I remember actually when we were just sort of laughing now. It's easy to laugh now, but when we were pitching for Ocado's next top supplier, and there was Stuart Rose and Tom Kerridge. And as soon as I started talking about my dad, I burst out crying uncontrollably. And I was like, trying to get it back together. My business partner was looking to me, so I just like step in. I'm like, no, I've got it.
I'm fine, yeah.
And then every time I started bursting out crying, I was like, this is just so embarrassing, you know. But yet they're all kind of like all a bit helpless because, you know, and you kind of think, crikey, you don't realise how much passion that had gone into this. And so, it's a lot easier now.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a way, when you've got small children, you're dealing with grief, trying to find something positive to channel into.
Well, and they're sharing it too.
Yes.
Which is incredible. It's incredible. Have you tasted it, Ollie?
I haven't.
We might have a little taste. We might have a little taste. So which one have you got there? You've got the traditional.
So I'll start. I always start. This is how the journey started. So
you're just going to have to stick your finger in there.
I know. Well, I've got these. You can have
got a spoon. Okay, that's cool.
Oh, gosh, hang on, yeah.
Spoon. I've got them all at home, so I'm all right. I've tasted them all. So I like... There's something about the smoked for me that goes really well with beetroot, I think. So it's nice. It looks like a ketchup, doesn't it, Ollie? It's a nice texture. Viva, do you want to have a go at that? I'd like your...
You're going straight in there. You're not actually eating it with something.
And I like your Eastern European...
So the ingredients in it are... Beetroot.
A little bit of apple.
Apple. And then you've kind of got the basic. We've got sort of brown sugar, red wine vinegar, a little bit of sea salt, a bit of olive oil, just to kind of emulsify it. Just keep it simple.
It's really nice.
You need to just sort of go back to basics because you sometimes look at the back of things.
Can we have the hot one? Because Ollie's never happy unless he's had a hot one. It's not actually that hot at all, is it? It is a warm hug, I would say. It's probably not hot enough for you, Ollie.
Wow.
But with cheese, beetroot ketchup sandwich, lovely.
Yeah.
I think. Or bacon, goes well with bacon.
Actually. I put that one with a bit of creme fraiche and I have it with hot smoked salmon. I think it makes a really nice Mary Rose sauce. So.
Thoughts on that, Ollie?
That's delicious. I mean...
You would not believe that beetroot can give it that. It gives it such an amount of body somehow, in a way that tomatoes don't quite, funnily enough.
What's nice is that the taste profile of it references ingredients rather than something kind of, you know, ketchup. Heinz ketchup references something otherworldly. It's a formula. And yes, it's a memory.
It's like Heinz tomato soup. Doesn't actually taste like tomato soup. It just tastes like Heinz tomato soup of its own. It has its own taste, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, then weirdly, I had a dinner in Parma last week where we were given some weird thing. And basically, everyone's like, well, hang on. That's basically soggy white bread in Heinz tomato soup. And it was like, you know, a sort of highly refined sort of Michelin star kind of appetizer.
There you go. Try the smoked one. That is my personal favourite. Yeah. I keep mine in the fridge. Do you have to? No.
Oh, well, I do because these are all natural products.
Yeah, and I like them cold as well.
Yeah,
anyway,
absolutely. Yeah. And because they're natural, they're always slightly different through the season and there's smoking because it's actually smoked over oak chips, the beetroot. It's going to be slightly different smokiness. I think that was quite a mellow one, that one.
And how long do they last for?
So, I mean, close 15 months, but if you open them, I would put them in the fridge. Just
a couple of months,
2 months.
Yeah,
and then you kind of, it says 4 weeks, but you know.
To be honest, mine don't last that long anyway.
So. No, not in our house.
Smoked, Viva?
Put them in.
So, yes, you know it's one of my favourites. I personally love the story and I think you're doing really, really well with it. Glad that you won the Food Talk Awards this year. We were pretty chuffed about that. That was good, wasn't it?
I didn't cry. Well, I almost did.
You almost did. Well done. Well done. Okay, well, we're going to have a little break now and then we're really excited to be talking to Viva, who has been doing food 3D printing. I don't even know how that works. Have you got any clue?
Well,
Ollie?
A little bit.
No clue.
I had my first 3D printed pasta in Parma last week.
Pasta.
Yeah, so it was the World Pasta Championship. Which is
You've got a dreadful job.
It's a terrible job. It's an event organised.
Do you do that all on business expenses?
So, well, actually, last year I was a judge. I was one of the. I was the only British judge. And this year I was there as sort of an influencer and someone talking about the event and writing about it. So I got to meet some really cool people. But Barillas has a 3D pasta printer.
One day they'll find you out, Ollie.
They will. They will. And it was amazing because there was one sort of spherical one which they filled with stuff from underneath. And I can show you some pictures. They were delicious, absolutely delicious, and really interesting. They actually printed a Roger Federer logo with it as well, which they gave to me. He's one of their sort of faces of Barilla in America.
Oh, wow.
So get your own personalised pasta now.
Yeah, great. We're just going to have a little break now, and then we're going to come back and speak to Viva. Meanwhile, I'm going to... I was talking to Chirag Khan of Nina's Popcorn, and she was making this incredible... chili popcorn at the recent Speciality and Fine Foods Fair. So let's just have a quick listen to that. I'm with Chirag Carrier, and he's got some beautiful, beautiful packets in front of me. That they're really sort of floral, they look lovely, and it's popcorn. It's popcorn, and it's called Nina's Popcorn, but you just said it's actually not Nina's Popcorn, it's Mum's Popcorn, is that right?
It's definitely Mum's Popcorn, yeah. She came up with the recipes, and it's all her. Nina's my mum. So.
Nina's your mum. So can you open some for me and I have a little taste? The reason why we're talking to Chirag is there are quite a few popcorn brands here, but none of them have got the flavours that are in Nina's popcorn. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, definitely. So we've tried to do something very unique with popcorn here. We've used superfood flavours, and the focus was to create gourmet popcorn that tastes great, but is also quite healthy for you. The entire range is popped in coconut oil. It's sweetened with unrefined sugar, so we use maple syrup. And, yeah, so we've got three flavours here. Cacao.
I've just tasted cacao, goji berries and pistachios. How you even crunch that up and make that into flavouring, I don't know.
Well, yeah, it was actually... We came up with this one quite late at night. It was like a Friday morning... around 2 o'clock, we're just messing around in the kitchen, and we all love chocolate at home, so we thought we'd come up with something. The focus was to try and find something with popcorn and chocolate, and we just thought the mix was great.
It doesn't taste really, really sweet. It's just got a nice level of sweetness, isn't it?
Yeah, we tried to keep it quite subtle, so you'll find that with the range, the maple syrup does sweeten the popcorn, but it keeps it quite subtle, so you can get through a bag without feeling
sick basically. Yeah. Can you open that one for me? That says, I don't even know how to pronounce that, spicy...
That's sriracha. So it's a Thai chili sauce.
Oh, wow.
And it's with spirulina, which is like a seaweed. You usually get it in like a tablet form, and people, or powdered form, and people usually put them in healthy smoothies, but we find that it pairs pretty well with something tangy and chili.
So we've got chili and something healthy for me. It's not too chili, is it?
It's very spicy, so I'd be careful with that.
Okay. Oh my goodness, Paul. I'm not asking Paul here. He's one of our producers. Paul, do you want to taste this? It's chili popcorn. It's a little bit too hot for me. You like chili, don't you?
Yeah. No problem. Okay, going in.
Is going in, and your thoughts on chili popcorn?
I'm actually going to have some more of that. It's really nice, actually. Initially, it doesn't burn your mouth off, and there it's you can just taste it in the back of your throat. Now it's nice. Yeah, no, very.
Nice. This is a bit of a Paul's a producer here. He's a bit of a chili aficionado, and it's very healthy for you apparently, Paul. So you can have the whole packet.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
He's going to steal the whole packet. There you go. We've also got another one here, which is pink salt and maca. And this is another thing I've never heard of.
Yeah, so we tried to do something with your classic sweet and salty popcorn. So the flavour is sweet coconut, Himalayan pink salt and maca. We added the maca because I think it pairs really well with maple syrup and creates a nice smoky flavour. Again, with the maple syrup, it's not too overpowering. And the pink salt, again, adds a new dimension to the flavour.
And what's maca? I've never heard of that.
Maca is a root vegetable, full of nutritional properties. And it's usually, again, in powdered form, people put them in healthy protein shakes and smoothies in the morning.
So can I have a little taste of that one? Do you mind opening that packet as well? I'm getting you to open all your packets. So Nina, your mum, it seems to me what you've got here is you've got a normal sort of ingredient that we all know, and then it seems like you're pairing it with something healthy, which is sort of a nutritional benefit. How do you know how to mix those together? Is it good old mum who's doing that, or you just start going, I'll taste that then, mum, and I'll take all the credit?
Well, I think it's actually just mum trying to get me to eat healthier. So I've always been a massive popcorn fan. It's always been in our house, and it's always been part of life. And she did try to get, and she got in the kitchen and got all these flavours together. And I was quite partial to a healthy smoothie in the morning. So these ingredients were always in the kitchen. And we just played around with it, and it created something awesome. And we just thought, I think people would actually like this. So we turned it into a product, and here we are.
There you go. And where can people get hold of Nina's popcorn?
So we actually launched the product last year, and it's currently available in Whole Foods as of a couple of days ago, Selfridges and Harrods.
Well, you can't get much better than that, can you? So if you fancy a bit of healthy, rather unusual popcorn, look out for Nina's, Harrods, Selfridges or Whole Food. And that was the lovely Chirag Khan. That popcorn was delicious, by the way. So we're back here at the Food Talk Show. We've been talking to Frankie Fox of the Foraging Fox, and we're now going to have a good old chat with Viva Kalnikaita. Hi, Viva. I know you were born in Lithuania?
Yes,
that's right. Yeah, and lots of beetroots out there, I should imagine.
Yeah, a lot of beetroot in the diet.
But no beetroot ketchup?
No.
Frankie, you need to get over. To Eastern Europe immediately.
Absolutely.
Yeah, immediately. Now, you have a very interesting background, I think. And so our sort of researchers have been digging around about you. And we know that you spent time studying at the University of Sheffield, and you have a degree in software engineering, which is great to see a female have a degree in software engineering. That's good. Really, really pleased about that. And you've got a PhD in human-computer interaction. Pretty brainy, I think. And then when you left university, you became an intern at the Microsoft Research Facility in Cambridge, focusing on quantified self technologies for recall of everyday memories. What on earth does that mean? put it into English for me, you know, really plainly, that I can understand.
So my PhD was looking at how people remember everyday conversations. So, for example, how I will remember our chat today.
I won't remember any of it. I'm getting old.
And I think it's really interesting as there's a lot of technology around us, a lot of the kind of cognitive tasks we offload it to technology around us. So, for example, we take notes and we kind of like don't remember people's phones, for example, anymore. But we know where to go and find them.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know anybody's phone number anymore. Whereas I just used to know them all, but now I don't because I don't need to.
Right?
No,
absolutely. Yeah, all this technology is supporting our brain.
Is that a good
activity.
Thing or a bad thing?
I think it's good. I think our kind of cognitive load is shifting to become more like an indexing kind of machine, essentially, rather than having to remember everything. And we're very good at kind of multitasking and knowing where to find this information and mixing.
So we're getting better at working out where to find stuff as opposed to actually remembering the detail of it.
Exactly, yeah. And there's technology that can remember detail a lot better than our kind of organic memories.
So, oh, that's a bit worrying, isn't it? So we're more and more devolving those responsibilities, if you like, to technology.
Yeah,
what
but
if
we
technology
kind of
just disappears off the planet of the, you know, off the planet.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen really, very anytime soon. But we kind of like we're becoming, you know, our brains are free to do really interesting and creative stuff. I think
mine
rather
doesn't.
Than focusing on kind of like detail.
Yeah. What do you think, Ollie? I mean, I haven't really thought about it before.
I think what's interesting is if you look at, you know, just in one's daily job, is there are now programs and there are now things that can essentially cut through analysis in a way that you simply couldn't as a human mind. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the great challenges is to work out how you leverage technology to your ends rather than you know, and then add value to your life. Because ultimately, if you then spend the rest of your day playing Angry Birds...
Yeah, not being a slave to it or being seduced by it.
And you know, and actually then, you know, because you no longer need to do X, actually there's more time to forage, there's more time to cook stuff from scratch, there's more time to... I think it's about the challenge for technology, and I think particularly for children and for the younger generations, is to leverage it in the right way. Because I don't think it's going anywhere. But it's a question of how you use it. And I also think for the older generation, actually, look at my father, who's 80, and how he uses technology is very interesting. It allows him to be much more connected in lots of ways. And I think that's where it's really great.
And where do you see it going? Just increasing in reliance on it?
I think we are already relying a lot on technology to do things for us. But I think the way we kind of like guiding technology, I think humans will be still in control. Figuring out what is the next thing that technology needs to do really well that maybe humans don't really want to do. Kind of getting that free time back, but also, you know, knowing that you kind of need to do all this kind of interesting stuff.
And given
stuff,
the way that sort of Frankie was brought up, you know, which I'm very envious of, do you think that we will use technology, as you say, to do those boring things, but actually what we might do is connect more and more in a very human sense and with the earth and with, you know, traditional pursuits more than ever, actually allowing us to buy the time to do those things, which is exactly what Ollie was trying to say.
I think so. I think there's definitely kind of, you know, if we engage technology in the right way, we have a lot more kind of free time that we can
be untechnical.
Exactly. Be untechnical and there's kind of finding that balance between technology free time and technology kind of busy time. And in a way, you know, a lot of technology, we're trying to humanize it around us as well. I think that's where kind of a lot of our design emphasis is currently looking, is how do you kind of humanize artificial intelligence, how you design artificial intelligence in a way that humans can really interact with it without having to learn these really complicated interactions.
Yes, and I do think that there's a lot of technology going on for the sake of it. Because we can do it, it's like, oh, great, well, we'll add that to a phone because, isn't that exciting and interesting? And yet 99.9% of the people who have that phone will never use it. And actually, it's irritating because it gets in the way of other things and it's taking up memory and whatever. And I do think we have to pare some of that down a bit.
I completely agree. So that's why I run a user experience design company. Our focus is really
kind of... That was a good segue, wasn't it? There you go.
It's really focusing on what problems we're solving with technology rather than building technology for the sake of building it.
So working your way backwards from it.
Exactly, yeah. I think there are a lot of engineering companies and technology companies that have a lot of kind of like interesting ideas, but the technology comes first and then the kind of application comes second. Whereas we're trying to figure out how kind of what problems we're solving and how we design it first before we actually build any technology.
Do you think there are any differences between males and females in terms of software engineering? You know, you having huge qualifications in that area, but a lot of women don't. They seem quite put off by it. And there's no reason why they should be, is there?
No, I don't think there is reason. I don't know why there's such a big difference in gender in these domains. But I know there's a lot of effort being made to kind of encourage females to study these subjects. And I'm meeting a lot of females in these subjects already and encouraging people to get really curious. And I think there are enough people to be curious.
Because technology has to be for everybody. So
absolutely,
yes. That'd be great. So explain to me exactly what 3D printing is. It, not to do with food, just what 3D printing is, full stop.
So 3D printing is a form of additive manufacturing. So it's a way of kind of building a 3D object by adding layers. So kind of in traditional 3D printing with plastics, you've probably seen a kind of a printer melting plastics and kind of distributing it in a pattern that's been designed in some software.
So it's almost like thin Lego. You build layer by layer like you would a piece of Lego.
Exactly.
Yep.
And then that's pretty much it. And there's different kind of materials that you can use to
It's for short run, isn't it? It's for one at a time,
so to speak.
As opposed to when you're in a factory, you're producing thousands and thousands of, you know, an hour. But this is an individualized.
It's more personalized. Although some people can make many objects of the same, but that tends to be more expensive way of manufacturing things and takes a longer time.
So Ollie was talking earlier about pasta. How would you 3D print pasta, does it have to be a liquid, like you've got a liquid plastic? Does it have to be a liquid in order to make something that then solidifies? How does it work?
It doesn't always have to be a liquid. Liquid could be one of materials that's used, but it could be a paste. Right. So kind of extruding a paste, and I guess that's how pasta is made. And then it solidifies. It could also be kind of a sugar, for example. You can use more like powdery materials and you kind of glue it together to
But it has to have something. It has to be something that has some type of liquid, at least some liquid to it, in order for it to have the consistency to go through the machine. Have I got that right?
Yeah, it has to be of the right consistency, I agree. Yeah. And sometimes that consistency can be manipulated either through kind of heating it up or cooling it down.
Right. And then at the end of the day, then it then solidifies.
Yes.
So that you get the final thing.
Yeah,
exactly. So you literally can put anything that you cook with that at the end of the day can solidify when it's cold. You could 3D print, so chocolate or...
Yes,
I don't
know. That's right. You can print with these materials.
Bread, thinking... bread, no, probably has to rise. No, that's not going to work.
Well, there's a pizza printer in US.
Pizza printer.
And it was originally funded by NASA, so cosmonauts could be, you know, astronauts could have pasta in space.
Excellent.
But yeah, it's the same technique. You kind of extrude a pasta base.
Okay, so you've got this company, and it's a 3D food printing robot company.
Yes, it's called NewFeed. It's a very new idea. And for this particular machine, we're using liquid as material.
Yeah.
So it has to be liquid. Could be even kind of more viscous liquid like ketchup. Or it could be quite runny.
Could you imagine making beetroot ketchup things?
Awesome.
Yeah.
So essentially what we're doing, we're kind of packaging liquid in 3D shapes. And novelty of this technique is that we can, the liquid inside the kind of these droplets and those shapes is always liquid. So when you bite into it, you still get this kind of runny sensation of
whatever. But the outside has like a coating on it.
The outside has a kind of very thin membrane.
Okay. So it's like biting into liqueur chocolate or something.
Yes. Like a raspberry. But kind of like a raspberry. And like it kind of explodes, individual droplets explode with different flavors.
Wow. And I don't even know where to start on this.
But you have to manipulate the liquids in order to. I can't just take tonic water, put it in the machine, and get.
That's right.
3D printed tonic water.
No, not yet.
Right. Can't believe you just said that. So, tonic water.
Well, you have like your own tonic water glass. You could pick up.
Oh, I see. I see what you mean. Yeah.
Okay, but so you're adding something to it.
Yes. So we created a new technique that is kind of. It's an extension of spherification techniques, modernist cuisine cooking techniques. But we've kind of made it in a way that it never solidifies and it always works in room temperature. And you can use any liquid, even kind of more complex liquids that have citrus ingredients in it.
God, fascinating.
Because on the video I saw that it droplets come out of the machine and drop into liquid.
That's right.
And the liquid that it's dropping into is playing a role, or is...
It does, yes.
Right.
It's kind of like it's controlling the speed of these droplets landing, but it's also allowing the kind of membrane to form, yes.
So this is a sort of digital food printing robot, in essence, which is probably like any other 3D printing machine. Probably looks slightly different, probably more technically advanced, but it's still a 3D printing machine.
That's right.
So you've got that, and what you're doing is you're really exploring different flavour pairings, different things that you can do with it, but specifically food?
That's right, yes. So we're focusing at the moment with food as a way, kind of like a way to play with it. So kind of delivering your condiments in maybe a mix of different flavours, in a kind of a 3D shape that you can accessorize any dish or any drink.
So if we take cocktails as an example. So
it's always back to alcohol, isn't it?
Do you know what? This is the research I have in front of me. I swear to you, that's true.
That's because they know who's going to read it.
Yeah, probably. but taking your, I mean, I said that was a silly idea, but actually, what you were trying to say is if I can get tonic that I can solidify in some sort of way, I could eat. Tonic,
yes.
is what you're trying to say. So if you were taking it, say you had a gin and you wanted to make a cocktail out of it, instead of adding, you know, the different sort of mixers or other types of spirits, what you could do is actually add individual pearls of flavour to the drink or individual shapes of something to the drink. So instead of just drinking it, you'd have all different sorts of flavour sensations and tastes and things that would burst in your mouth as part of that.
Exactly.
As part of that drink. See, it's easy to explain it as a drink, you must have made.
But the output, because I've seen it done with coffee in spherification. Mm-hmm. So is the output always a caviar-type substance?
It's a caviar-type substance,
as yeah. As round and, yeah.
Yeah, it's round, but it's connected together. So the shape, so for example, you could make a cube out of coffee.
But it's formed of lots of different droplets.
Yes, that's right.
So basically, the spherification, because you can do home spherification, yeah. I should say. I have a home spherification kit at home.
You would, wouldn't
which
you?
I have to say I have never unwrapped.
But to be fair, you've got...
I saw it over the weekend.
To be fair, you've got a tortoise as well, so...
I have. She's very well at the moment.
Good. Pleased about that. So you've got a home spherification.
Yeah. So spherification, it's an interesting area because it's sort of... It drifts in and out of fashion within the Michelin star kind of world. Because this is very Michelin star cooking, is what we're talking about. I mean, yeah. Home spherification is really for the kind of culinary insane, as I call us.
Culinary insane. But if you take somebody like Jules, which is JOOLS, they've been looking at spherification in a sort of industrial sense in the food sector. Because spherification for cooking generally will only last 36, 48 hours. Whereas they've managed to create something that would last for 3 or 4 months, which is really, really difficult. And obviously what they've done is they've looked at a sort of process which will allow you to put all these different tastes into a sphere or caviar, as you say, this sort of, mm-hmm. and then they'll burst in your mouth. And they're experimenting that with drinks. Mm-hmm. You're experimenting with that in an individual basis almost, aren't you? Allowing people to
yes, exactly.
As Ollie said, the culinary insane, or you know, somebody who's doing product development can actually play around with those flavors and textures.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, is this a consumer device or is this a business device?
It's a consumer. The vision is to have a consumer.
So you're imagining the people who have bought Meyerwald's crazy book on modernist cuisine at £800 would be happy to pick up one of these pieces of kit.
I think either there's people who cook really well or really interested in kind of experimenting with new flavors and presentation, or people who don't actually cook that much but want to have really nice flavors.
Or are quite interested in the sort of chemistry process as opposed to the
yes, exactly.
you know, the arty-farty cooking process.
But there's a massive overlap, and we've always seen this between developers and scientists and food. So like my chairman, who is an amazing home cook, you know, his background is in coding and development. Mm. And actually, you know, that because those kinds of brains are kind of like, well, hang on, what, if you change this and you do that, what happens? And then applying that to a home environment, the easiest space to do that is the world of food.
Yeah.
So actually, I can totally see how...
A lot of microbiologists in food as well, isn't there? Microbiology for people who are brewing and doing all those sorts of things. Whereas I'm a cook that is... what I would call an old-fashioned cook, where I just taste things and add things, you know. So the way something tastes and smells is important to me. I don't actually follow a recipe. I just, you know, do that.
You're what we call a freestyler.
Freestyler, is that what they're called? That sounds much better. Yeah,
my wife is a freestyler.
Yeah, so I'm a freestyler. Yeah,
freestyling.
So, same meal twice.
Yes.
No.
So that wouldn't appeal to me because it's a bit scientific. But there are lots of people who like the very scientific, you know, experimental thing, which is what it would be aimed at.
Yeah, but there's also an element of play. So you could create something totally new that no one else has been able to create with those particular flavors.
So the kit itself, I've seen on the videos and stuff, there's like I'm going to call it a machine. Mm-hmm. And then if you bought one of these machines, what else would you get, would you need to have with it?
So you would get little bottles of flavors, and they would be kind of themed. So you'd get a cocktail flavor box with different flavors to go with gin or...
See, they're
whiskey.
Going straight up the drink aisle.
Yeah. Our friend from Zing, you need to meet...
World of Zing.
The World of Zing.
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
Do you know him? I'm going to introduce you to him.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's about those playing around with flavours. And he's particularly interested in spices, of course. So that would be great.
Spices and drink.
Well, it's pretty difficult to describe on the radio. I would advise anybody to go to, is it newfood.io, if I got that right? And that's NUFWD.io, but if you go onto our website, you'll find that. And you do have to look at the Vimeo video, because that does explain it. It's quite difficult to explain that.
And where are you on the journey in terms of, are you about, am I about to be able to pick one up for Christmas, or is it...
So at the moment we're preparing to sell, kind of take pre-orders from very early adopters. So we have a, so if you would like to join our early adopters.
And they could be beta testing for you.
Yes, exactly. Mm. So it's kind of full support for a year. And
see, he's got a big smile on his face now you said that. So definitely you need to grab him, really, don't you? You'd love that, wouldn't you? You'd love that, wouldn't you? Yeah, that's good. So please go onto the website and look at the video in particular. And are you asking for people to put themselves forward if they're interested in
yes, we have a sign up little form on our website.
Get on there if it's one of those things for you. And unbelievably, the program's coming to an end already very, very quickly. Sorry about that. We could talk about ages about that. Frankie, thank you so much for joining us again. Nice to see you again. Foragingfox.com. And to be honest, it's just everywhere now, isn't it?
Let's like face foxes. It.
Yeah. I
not
get
wrong.
Yeah. So loads of delis, and if you go on Foraging Fox, it'll tell you where to go. If you haven't tried beetroot ketchup, I'd give it a go. Obviously, if you don't like beetroot, that's not going to work. But definitely give it a go.
Oh, even if you don't like beetroot, I challenge you.
There's a challenge there. So fascinating stuff. Thank you very much, Viva. I'm going to talk to you after this program because I want to know loads more, don't you? It's absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show, and we're now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield, from California to the Kent coast, Manchester to Michigan, I think, now, even Malta. And thank you to my fellow presenter, Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Thank you, Ollie. If you want to recommend any future guests, or you want to ask us any questions or anything like that, do get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow. Or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, like my dear friend Jan Hawkins. Hello, Jan Hawkins, over there in America. She keeps emailing me and telling me where I've gone wrong on the show. Do go to foodtalk.co.uk or on iTunes or any of those, and you can find us there. Have a good week. Bye.